Grace to you and peace from God our Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Do you know what a name dropper is? It's that person who has the habit of mentioning important or famous people who they've either met or have some sort of a tangent, like you, Brian. I know Brian, folks. So, for example, there's a lady in my mom's building who, within a week of my mom moving in there, let her know that her nephew is Tom Brady. Just worked it into the conversation. Worked it into the conversation as naturally as possible. Now, before we begin to judge her, I would suspect that each of us has dropped a name or two during a conversation. A couple weeks ago, we were at Synod Assembly, and I can assure you, there was a lot of name dropping going on during Synod Assembly, and not all of it was trying to make a person appear important. Some of it, I'm sure, was. But some of it, we do that if we're trying to make connections, right? If you told me that you had some connection to the courts in Sacramento County, I might ask if you knew my father. Or if you told me that you had some sort of connection to the schools in Elk Grove, I might ask if you know my mother. Not to drop their names, but just looking for connections. But sometimes name dropping is just done to try and look important or one-up somebody. Our reading this morning begins with a name being dropped. But in this instance, we know the name of the person that is being mentioned, but the new king of Egypt at the time apparently doesn't know who Joseph is. And it seems implausible that he wouldn't know who Joseph is. Apparently he didn't go to Sunday school before worship. And I suppose it is possible he didn't know who Joseph was because it had been nearly 400 years since Joseph had lived in Egypt. And I guess over that time, maybe people forgot a thing or two. But I'm sure we all know who Joseph was, right? We all know the story? Well, I'll just go ahead and give you a few highlights in case you just need your memories refreshed. And we'll start with where we left off last Sunday's sermon. If you were here last Sunday, you might remember that Jacob wrestled all night with God, and that God ended up changing Jacob's name to Israel. And the morning after he had wrestled with God all night, Jacob was reconciled with his brother Esau, who forgave him, and he moved back home to the land of Canaan. Now, Jacob had 12 sons, and he had a favorite son. I mean, they say you don't have favorites, but let's be honest. And Joseph was Jacob's favorite son, and his brothers resented him for it. You see, Joseph not only was a dreamer himself, but he could interpret dreams. And his brothers resented it so much that they threw him into a pit and eventually sold him to a band or caravan of Ishmaelites in order that he might become a slave. And then they took the beautiful robe that their father had given to Joseph and not to any of the rest of them, and they put goat's blood on it, and they let their father believe that his beloved son Joseph had in fact been killed. What happened to Joseph then was he was taken to Egypt by the Ishmaelites, and he was sold there as a slave. But it didn't take Joseph long to endear himself to his new owner because he began to interpret his dreams. And eventually, the Pharaoh at the time heard about Joseph's ability to interpret dreams and asked to have his dreams interpreted as well. And Joseph was able to tell Pharaoh that there was a big famine coming, and that in order to prepare for it, they needed to start saving up grain. They needed to start storing up grain so they'd be ready for this famine. And it turns out the famine came, and the Egyptians had a lot of grain, and they did okay. But the people who didn't live in Egypt didn't do as well. And so at some point during the famine, Jacob sends some of his sons into Egypt to try and buy some grain because they didn't have any. And when Joseph's brothers show up and ask to buy grain from Joseph, they fall on the ground and they keep their faces hidden because Joseph was a person of importance and they were not. And they didn't recognize that it was their brother they were trying to buy grain from, but Joseph knew his brothers. He couldn't forget those who had thrown him in a pit and sold him to be a slave. Well, Joseph accused them of being spies, and he threw them in prison for 3 days. But when they were released, he sold them the grain that they had asked for, and when they left with the bags of grain that they had bought, they opened the first bag and realized that Joseph had put the money they had given to him in that bag of grain. He had returned the money to them. They didn't know why. It didn't make sense to them. And the next time they came to Egypt to buy grain, finally, Joseph decided to tell them who he is, to tell them that he is their brother. Well, they didn't believe him. It seemed implausible that their brother, who they sold into slavery, could now be the second most powerful man in all of Egypt and in control of all the grain. And Joseph explained to them everything that had happened in the intervening time and how he came to be the person who controlled the grain in all of Egypt. And then he asked if his father was still alive. And he was so relieved to learn that, in fact, Jacob was still alive. And he sent his brothers to get him and said, "All of you come, and we will find a place for you to live in Egypt." That, my friends, is how the Israelites, how the 12 tribes of Israel, whose name had been changed from Jacob to Israel, all came to live in Egypt. And our story begins 400 years later, when the Israelites had become numerous, and there was a new king who didn't know who Joseph was. Now, we're talking about dropping names. It's interesting that the writer didn't drop in the name of this new king or new pharaoh. We aren't told who it is. So a lot of people have a lot of theories about who it might be. But the most important thing for us to know about this new king is not what his name was, but the fact that he was afraid of the Israelites. He was afraid of them and tried to control them by putting taskmasters over them and making them work hard and to do really difficult things that required a lot of energy and were dangerous. And the harder he made them work, the more they prospered and the more numerous they became. That sort of brings us up to speed to chapter 1. We didn't read from chapter 2, but if we'd read chapter 2 in Exodus, we would read some more stories about what happened in Egypt at that time. Pharaoh was afraid of the Israelites, and so he commanded, told two of the Israelite midwives that every time a male Israelite baby is born, they were supposed to take its life, not let it live through birth. And these midwives didn't honor that request. They kept saying, "Oh, you know, these Israelite women are so sturdy and hardy, they don't even need us there to help them give birth. And by the time we get there, the baby's already thriving and there's nothing we could do." So then Pharaoh decides, well, if we can't eliminate them at birth, that he puts out an edict that every male baby that is discovered is supposed to be thrown into the Nile. And it's during that time that that Moses is born to the line of Levi. Levi was one of Joseph's brother. Moses is born, and when he's born, his mother hides him for 3 months until she can't hide him any longer. And then she decides that she's going to put him in a basket, and she places the basket in the Nile, sort of to the letter of the law, doing what Pharaoh said, right? Take those male babies and put them in the Nile. It's just that she put him in a basket that floated and set him right where Pharaoh's daughter would discover her. And that's what happened. Pharaoh's daughter discovered baby Moses there in the basket in the Nile and took her and brought her back to Pharaoh's house to raise her as her own. And as luck would have it, she hired Moses' real-life mother to be her wet nurse. And Moses is raised in Pharaoh's household. An Israelite raised among the Egyptians. And it works out pretty good for Moses until he begins to see how Pharaoh is treating the other Israelites, how Pharaoh is treating those he knows are part of his family, his clan, his people. And so when he sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating an Israelite, Moses gets angry and he kills the Egyptian. And he takes that Egyptian's body and he hides it and so that he wouldn't be discovered. But soon enough, Pharaoh figures out what's happened, hears, and he decides that Moses needs to be eliminated. So Moses flees to the land of Midian, and he encounters a priest named Jethro, and he begins to help him tend his flocks and marries his daughter, Zipporah. And that is where we find ourselves in chapter 3 of our reading, with Moses tending Jethro's flock, coming up to Mount Horeb, which is also Mount Sinai, and encountering that bush, that burning bush that never burns up. And the voice of the Lord crying out, "Moses, Moses." Moses replied, "Here I am." And as Mr. Justin mentioned, God told him, "Don't come any closer. Take off your shoes. This is holy ground. This is not your ordinary encounter with a burning bush that doesn't burn up. This encounter is special." So God tells Moses that he wants him to go to Pharaoh and to bring God's people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And Moses responds the way most of us would have responded. He said, "Uh-uh, not going to do it." And Moses says that he is not worthy. So God goes ahead and responds to that. Says, "Well, it's all right. I'll go with you. I'll go with you. What could you be afraid of? I got your back." So Moses decides he's got to take a different tact. And he says, "Okay, well, if I go, when the people ask me who sent me, what shall I say?" God replied, "You shall say to the Israelites, 'I am has sent you.'" "I am has sent you." Well, that should clear it up. There'll probably be no follow-up questions to that, right? Oh, got it. Go ahead, y'all leave. It's good. "I am has sent you." Well, Moses continued to object and try to deflect God's call, but ultimately Moses couldn't deny God's command to go. And Moses went. Moses went because God had sent Moses to Egypt to release God's people from the vicious hand of Pharaoh. God sent Moses because God had heard God's people's cries, and God wanted to deliver them from the pain that they suffered. God sent Moses because Moses could speak, maybe with a stutter, but he could speak the language of the Egyptians and the Hebrew people. God sent Moses because God loved and trusted Moses, and because God loved God's people who were being treated unjustly. My friends, Moses wasn't the only one that was sent by God. If you've read the Bible, you've read and seen that others were sent as well. But each of us has been and are being sent by God. Each of us are being called by God to go. We are being sent to proclaim the release of our neighbors from their captivity to their sin-filled lives. We too are being sent by God with the good news of God's love, the good news of life after death, the good news of our release from the consequences of our sin, which would surely lead to death without Jesus Christ. And the question for us, those of us who are being sent, is the same as it was for Moses. The same question that Moses asked God, we too should be asking, who are we going to tell the people has sent us? Whose name are we going to drop when the people ask about this God that we say we have been sent by to tell them about? How are we going to describe God to the people we encounter? How are we going to describe the God that we've gathered this morning to worship? You showed up to worship God. Tell me about that God. Are you prepared to describe the God you came here to worship today? Have you figured out who that God is to you? Have you figured out what language you would use to describe God to somebody else? God told Moses to tell the people that "I am has sent him." And you could try it. Try it. I suspect that it will lead to more questions. how would you describe God in a conversation? If asked, what would you say is God's name? What would you say is God's name? How do you refer to God and why? What is it about your relationship with God that compels you to use certain language, a certain name to refer to God? I suspect the answer would be different for each and every one of us. And I suspect that the answer might be different for us based on the context in which we're being asked the question. I might describe God very differently to a 3-year-old child than I would to a college-age student who tells me they're an atheist. I'd probably use different language to describe who I understand God to be. Same God, but different language, even perhaps different names. I think the challenge for us, the call, if you will, is for each of us to do what Moses did, which is to ask the question, who has sent you? And then be prepared to answer that question. Answer it for yourself, and be prepared to answer that question with those you encounter. Whose name are you going to drop? How are you going to describe God? And what, for you, is God's name? Amen.